You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the podcast where we're talking about Bitcoin. Today's guest is backed by popular demand and his name is Parker Lewis. Parker is a noted thought leader in the Bitcoin space for some of his outstanding writings, and he's also an executive at Unchained Capital. On the show today, we cover his thoughts on supply chains, debt ceilings, trillion-dollar Fed coins, how the political environment is changing at the state level, and much, much more. So without further delay, here's my discussion with the thoughtful Parker Lewis.
You're listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
All right. So like I said in the introduction, I'm here with Parker Lewis. Parker, welcome back to the show.
Preston, good to be on. Look forward to catching up.
So you're a really busy guy. And so what in the world's happening in your neck of the woods?
Well, we had an event here in Austin over the last few days. Technically, the Texas Blockchain Summit, I refer to it as the Texas Bitcoin Summit. but we had Senator Cornyn and Senator Cruz from the state of Texas in town. And then we also had Senator Lummis all speak at the same event on Friday. It was a great host of people. A lot of people from the Bitcoin community were in town talking about the kind of really centric to everything that's happening around Bitcoin in Texas. So that was fun. And then after that on Friday, I actually made it down to College Station last night to see Texas A&M, which I'm actually, even though I didn't go to Texas University of Texas, I'm not an Aggie. I'm a lifelong Longhorn. But went down to College Station last night. It was first time to see an Aggie game in Aggie land. So that was pretty fun. They knocked off Alabama.
You just had to point that out. Hey,
you know, actually I knew you were in Alabama. I actually didn't know if you were a Bama fan or Auburn. You know, I don't know where they draw the lines.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it's a pretty big rivalry between those two here in Alabama. But if I had to pick, I'd say Alabama. Hey, so answer this for me. So when I think about the various states, I automatically Wyoming comes to the forefront as just being kind of out there and leading the charge when it comes to the legislation, the state legislation. Texas is obviously vying for that similar spot. So how do you view it? How do you view Texas in contention across all 50 states, and where can they improve? What are they doing right? I'm curious to hear your point of view as somebody who's intimately familiar with this in the state of Texas.
Yeah, I think one distinction, and I love the state of Wyoming. I think that not only just being welcoming and forward thinking about crafting legislation, but then also having Senator Lummis there in Wyoming, a big advocate in the U.S. Senate, which I think is just for the broader Bitcoin movement, it's a really important voice. And it sounds like someone like Senator Cruz is coming along there as well. The more the better. But I think one distinction between a state like Wyoming and a state like Texas is they really led from a legislative perspective first. There wasn't a big Bitcoin community. I think there's a lot of things about Wyoming why Wyoming and Bitcoin will be a perfect match. But they really started with the legislative side. And really in Texas, I think it's been the reverse, which is that there are a lot of natural, non-legislative, non-regulatory reasons why Bitcoiners and the Bitcoin industry will flourish here. And I would really probably, if I was to summarize it, the energy, the deregulated, so natural resources, the deregulated energy grid, and then the fact that mineral rights are almost 100% privately owned in the state of Texas, which is not the case in a state like Wyoming. But then on top of that, Austin is has become over the last decade a tech hub, you know, in a broader speaking sense than just Bitcoin. And then when you add on top a fairly favorable tax climate and with no state income tax and strong property rights, that's really, it's the combination of those three, the energy dynamic, the tech dynamic, and then the tax and regulatory environment here. And when you add those three things together, it really becomes a gravitational force that's bringing the Bitcoin industry to Texas. And I don't think that when, you know, ultimately Bitcoin's going to be everywhere, but kind of in terms of leading the charge over the next several years, decades, that I do expect Texas to be a leader for. You know, I don't know if you've ever read the book. It's not necessarily one of my favorite books, but there's a book called The Accidental Superpower, that that book's about America. But in Texas, and as it relates to Bitcoin, that there are strategic advantages that you can't recreate that already exist here that will allow it to lead.
When you talk about the tech hub there in Austin, I've often wondered, like, what's driving that? What has created? Because it seems like just in the last 5 to 10 years, that's really kind of emerged as a tech hub, where you go back 20 years, I don't remember that ever being really the case. So what's driving that? Is it just the tax incentives that are doing that, or is there something else?
I think, and you know, while I'm not a student of this history, I did grow up in Austin, Texas. I'm a native here. And, you know, growing up, Austin was really a kind of sleepy college town. The Capitol was here, so it was more than just the University of Texas. But Michael Dell, I think if you trace back the history of Austin becoming a tech hub, it would be the founding of Dell and Michael Dell that started to, you know, kind of that was on the wave of you know, kind of really before personal computers, you know, before there was a home in every house, Michael Dell and Dell were core to that. And then there was, you know, kind of all the ancillary industries that built up around Dell. And then kind of once that flywheel started, then you also, I'd say, probably add to it the political and regulatory climate in other areas, right? So when you know, it's not just tax, but I think just 2 days ago, Tesla announced that they were moving, that things might seem to be accelerating, but those same underlying trends that once there was a tech flywheel that probably would be traced back to Dell, realistically, the same things that are causing businesses to move to Texas today existed 10 years ago. It's just becoming more obvious to more people. Apple has their second largest campus here. But so there's also just a lot of developers, a lot of engineers. The university has a big computer science program. So that also drives it. A lot of people who go to UT stay in UT. And so there's just a lot of computer engineers that are here as well. So and then it attracts a certain type of people that generally prefer kind of a more individualistic, you know, kind of individual freedom based movement. So, you know, probably a combination of a number of reasons.
Hey, so on your profile, I've noticed this for a while, but I've never asked you about it. Your profile says buy Bitcoin, delete Facebook. What's the background, or what's the story on the second part there?
I deleted Facebook a long time ago. You know, I think Facebook is the social network. I view money and Bitcoin as a social network as well. It's a social consensus as to what the new form of money is going to be. But I don't think that there could be a greater contrast between Bitcoin and the social good that it will drive. And I don't think that there's a worse company in America than Facebook. It's just, you know, kind of the vitriol. It's like it's a place for people to go and, you know, scream at all of the people that they don't like. And ultimately, Facebook monetizes that. And so I think it's a really, it's very divisive. I think, you know, there was, I don't know how many years ago, but they basically did an experiment on some of their users to see if they could affect their emotions. Where if they put negative news in their feed, if that could, you know, trigger certain actions, obviously it could. And then I think people started posting basically just the the filter of the 10% of how they wanted to portray themselves to the rest of the world. And so just for a number of reasons. And then I think about people sitting on their phones and, you know, getting into spats about politics and for 4 or 5 hours a day rather than doing something productive. So, if they're, you know, kind of comes back to them both being social networks, Bitcoin, not in terms of like Bitcoin, Twitter and, you know, socializing, but that money actually is a social consensus. It's a social network. And that it will lead to social good and that Facebook basically does the opposite. So if there's a company that's not going to survive the Bitcoin standard, I would say it's Facebook.
I love it. I'm not a fan of Facebook either. What are your thoughts on all the supply chain issues that are happening right now? What's driving it? What's going to be the long-term impact of it? Just some of your thoughts.
I think that it would be impossible to point to any one thing that is driving the supply chain issues. And I think that this is one of the things that that a lot of macro investors will make an error. I believe it's a fool's errand. Well, they'll point to, you know, the Evergrande situation, or they'll point to COVID, or they'll point to the response to COVID with the vaccine mandates. And, you know, we're seeing today that there's 1,000 cancellations on Southwest Airlines flights. And but then some of it's driven by the fact that, you know, planes aren't in right places. And so the reality is that the U.S. economy and the global economy are extremely complex, and that the U.S. financial system and the global financial system are incredibly fragile. So to point to any one thing, I think it isn't any one thing. It is the culmination of 30 to 40 years of fiscal and monetary irresponsibility, combined with, you know, in more recent time, a government that thinks that they can take a highly complex system, more complex, you know, maybe rivaling the complexity of the human body, and just stop it, and then think that things aren't going to go back to normal. And, you know, they never were, but it was an accelerant to the disruption. And so I think that when you basically take that combination of complex economic system, highly complex supply chains, just on time delivery type, with you know, I don't know how many vendors would be in a car or would be in a computer, but hundreds, that as soon as there's a problem with one, then it causes delays of others, and then solvency, of different parts of solvency issues in different parts of the supply chain, that it just starts to have a ripple effect. And so to then be able to zoom back out and say, well, was it because the government shut down? Well, I was like, well, no, because the U.S. financial system was already incredibly fragile. Why was it fragile? Well, that's a story of 30 to 40 years. Every time the economic system tried to eliminate imbalance, the Federal Reserve created an environment where imbalance could be sustained and then grow. And that then when you have shocks, ultimately everything comes home to roost. So I do think that it's, you know, it's like a Pandora's box that it's out. I don't see how it gets better before things get a lot worse. And I think that it ultimately will be, you know, kind of going through a restructuring of the entire system.
So this is not temporary. What we're seeing right now in supply chains is just getting started. Is that what you're saying?
I believe so. I'm not an expert on supply chains, but I do have an understanding of the U.S. financial system and the complexity of the broader economic system. And so when I, you know, kind of anecdotally, when I hear about a car dealership here in Austin that typically sells 11,000 cars a year and have been told that they're only going to get 1,800 deliveries next year, there is a whole host of inputs that could create that dynamic, as well as consequences. People that are going to have to be fired, car prices having to be increased, more businesses that are in the supply chain of cars becoming impacted by that. I don't know how, given the landscape in the U.S. financial system, the imbalance that exists within the broader economy, the rate at which they're printing money, and kind of the talk around tapering, that this is something that has to play out. That you don't just magically, you can't turn. People, whether it's in the government or the central banks, that think this is like turning on a light switch and that you can turn it off and turn it back up. It just expresses a large degree of naivety, but then also just a lack of understanding of the stakes at play.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Our friends at Corient provide wealth management services centered around you. Corient's goal is to exceed your expectations and simplify your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. They are one of the largest integrated fee-only U.S. registered investment advisors, and Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. The teams at Corient put the collective power of their expertise into building you the custom wealth, investment, and family office solutions that can help you reach your holistic financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, speak with an advisor today at Corient.com. That's spelled Corient.com. That's Corient.com. When Rain Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rain was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
You know what I find interesting about this one, Parker, is when you look at all the action that's been done by central banks over the last decade, it's almost like they always had a lever to pull to reflate things. So like the market was kind of throwing a tantrum back in 2015, then it did it again in the 2018, 2019, and it did it again. Then we had the COVID, and each time it did this, and we're talking about, a 20% plus correction on the S&P 500, the central bankers would step in, they would exercise more QE, they would drop interest rates, they would play all those games with the levers that they had to pull, and it would reflate the stock market, right? The rest of the economy in the U.S., I think, got more unstable and more unstable as all this was going on. And we're really starting to see that now here in 2021. But right now with the supply chain piece, this isn't something that they're able to kind of pull a lever to. So we've had a CPI print, which is the gauge that they're forcing everybody to look down and say, this is what inflation is, at 5% for the last, I don't know, five months, we've had CPI at 5%. And based on everything that you just described and everything that we've been seeing, it seems like it's not going to go away. And so, like, they're going to keep doing this. They're going to keep playing these games, but they can't make that CPI disappear, or they can't make these supply chains get better by doing more quantitative easing. And so I'm just kind of interested, you know, like, what's the strategy? What does this look like moving forward in the next 6 months? You had implied that, you know, you don't think it's going away. Does it amplify? Does it get worse? What are some of your thoughts on it?
So, I think that, you know, the way that I look at this, you know, especially if you talk to investors in the hedge fund community, you know, kind of wherever it might be, but traditional financial markets, they will look at 2008-09, which was very similar to March to June and into this year of printing money. They will say something very consistent, as if they are all just parroting each other's lines, which they'll say that as to the Fed printing trillions of dollars, they'll say it was crazy, it's not going to end well, but they had to do it. It's like almost verbatim, you will hear a bunch of macro investors and high finance types parrot that line, and that they don't actually provide any logic between it's not going to end well and they had to do it. And that it really just ends at it's not going to end well, but that once you start to understand what actually happens through the function of the Fed printing money via quantitative easing, it is that there is economic imbalance that exists and the market is trying to heal and eliminate that imbalance. And the function of central banks printing money, to sum it up in my mind, does two things. It allows imbalance to continue to exist and grow, but that it also causes the deterioration of the monetary unit that coordinates economic activity. And that is the really destructive piece, because one of the things I talk about a lot as it relates to Bitcoin is this idea that money and economic systems converge to a single monetary medium, very naturally to the function of money. But more realistically, what happens is that economic systems emerge from one money, that an economic system actually derives from a particular form of money. And what that means is that the supply chains only exist because a broader and broader set of people with a broader and broader set of capabilities all use the same money. And that when the Fed does that combination of two things, allow imbalance to continue to exist and grow, as well as cause the underlying unit, monetary unit, to not just depreciate, but to become less reliable, that when we see these supply chain issues, it's basically, you know, a ship where water is leaking from all parts of the boat and it's about to go under. And what they were essentially doing was whack-a-mole. But just like we all know that it's not going to end well when they print trillions of dollars, it really isn't. And it's not to say that this is necessarily the last cycle. I don't operate, I think timing and, you know, part of the recognition that economic systems are incredibly complex, it's not worth necessarily predicting. It's worth being prepared for all interim weathers, but also knowing what the end state is. That is core to surviving all weathers. The thing that I try to articulate, and I have one of the articles I've written is Bitcoin is common sense. I try to visualize for people, or get them to at least get this train of thought of, like, how when the Fed prints, you know, they've printed $1.1 trillion just this year, They printed, I believe, like $4.5 trillion since March of 2020. That if you actually think about the operation of like, they just literally click a button on a screen and that's how the money gets created. There's probably a few people that have to, you know, there's probably some financial control to ensure that not one person can just print trillions of dollars by clicking one button on the screen. But that is functionally how money is created in this system. And that through that operation, nothing, like at the moment when the Fed puts $1 trillion in, nothing economically changed. All that happens is the balance of who gets to allocate the monetary capital in the system has now been altered by the Federal Reserve. You know, imagine there's X amount of money and then there's X plus $1 trillion. Well, the distribution of that money is different. Now the economic system is fundamentally different in this case, existing in a world where there's greater and greater imbalance. And so once the, you know, kind of once the bow starts to burst at the seam, you know, it's like, you know, you can pull on the thread, you can't push it back in. And that's essentially what's happening. Once the system is obviously structurally broken and people are losing their jobs and people and more people are dependent on government checks, it only can accelerate, right? So can they rescue it like they did in 2008 and 2009? And can they rescue it like they did in March of 2019? It would seem, you know, it's like never say never, but we also didn't see those type of supply chains. And the thing that I articulate for people as well is that hyperinflation is not just a function of, and I don't like to use that term in a dystopian or fear-driven way, but when I just explain it as a natural function, it's the way every fiat currency will ultimately end. There's an idea that I think it's just something that is true that is inarguable, that the value of any good will trend towards its marginal cost to produce. And the cost to produce a dollar is zero. The cost to produce $3 trillion is zero. The cost to produce 15 trillion Venezuelan bolivars is zero. That this is a logical endgame, that people understand that that dollars are becoming more and more abundant, but hyperinflation doesn't just occur because governments print money. What is actually happening is the monetary unit is becoming less and less effective at its exclusive purpose, which is coordinating economic activity, facilitating trade and exchange. And that as those supply chains break down, then you've got more and more money at the same time that you have less and less real goods. And you have a lot of people that will have a lot of the money and a lot of people that won't have any at all. And that has a very negative feedback loop. And then once it becomes apparent that there aren't real goods and services, or that that there are fewer and fewer of those, and you have a dynamic where there's fewer and fewer real goods and services, and at a time where there's more and more money, that it's the combination of those two things. But what actually happened on the lowest level was that the printing of money actually created the imbalance and created the environment where the supply chains would break down because the system was so fragile.
Talk to us about the debt ceiling. So recently there was a lot of concern whether this was going to get passed. Everyone started talking about minting a $1 trillion coin. What is going on here? What are some of your ideas on this one?
So I think this discussion is it's the perfect jumping off point for that last part about, you know, the Fed prints money, but the U.S. government is in a scenario where the Fed has to print money. Essentially, the Fed, and when I say has to, it's not, I mean, there is a reality that they shouldn't, but we also have to operate in the reality of understanding not only what their psychology is, but what their economic worldview is, as well as the degree of leverage in the system that dictates that if they're going to continue their charade on, that they must print money. It would be, they would all have to forget everything that they thought they knew for the last 40 years to reverse course and not do that. But the dynamic that's happening is there is a because there's such a high degree of leverage in the financial system that when there's a shock to the system, like what happened with COVID, but I also do like to reiterate for people that the imbalance was already existing. The repo markets broke in September of 2019. There was a massive imbalance in the oil markets that had already appeared in January and February of 2020, and then COVID happened. But COVID was an accelerant that with a financial system that is as leveraged as it is, and then the economic system shutting down like it was, that the Fed system needs credit expansion, otherwise the credit system will collapse. The Fed does not understand that, but that is the dynamic at play. Because the financial system is so highly leveraged that if it's not growing, if growth slows or growth contracts, the entire system implodes. One default actually causes the next. It's a very negative feedback loop. But when we're in a period like we are today where growth is slowing and confidence is at potentially all-time lows, there's a natural function to want to contract credit. The credit impulse is impaired in those scenarios, in the current scenario, and that the Fed really needs the public system credit to expand because it needs the overall credit system to expand. So it one way or the other, not only will fund the federal government in its pursuits of, $1.5 trillion and $3.5 trillion, whatever the budget might turn out to be. But there's effectively a partnership there. There's a constitutional separation of those powers. And the Fed is technically a private entity, but at this point, the bed is made and they are wed. And so there's, for my entire, I'd say, professional career, I can't remember how many of these instances there have been, but they all end the exact same way, that the debt ceiling, there will be political gamesmanship, but they're all just doing it to get what they want. They all have different motivations, but they all want something. And they derive a lot of power by the government actually running. And that's true of both sides. And so right now there's a lot of nerves in the market. There's the Fed talking about tapering, and there's the federal government, kind of debating a $1.5 trillion to $3.5 trillion budget. And there's a debt ceiling looming. And the reality is if you think that this time is different, that is the foolish position. Their entire system collapses, and they're highly motivated to not have that happen from a power structure standpoint. And so right now, my view is the same thing will happen as it always does, which is they'll get to the last minute. They might even shut down the government for a period of time, and then they'll increase the debt ceiling. And all the while, the debt and the entire system will continue to grow, and the Fed will be the one that finances it. Like you mentioned, there was the reference of the $1 trillion coin. And my understanding of that, while it is not highly technical, is that, in the current system, the Fed is actually the one that creates dollars. And it's the Treasury that prints dollars. So that when a bank wants to convert a digital reserve to a physical note, the Fed doesn't print that, the Treasury does, but the Fed puts in essentially a request. And then that digital reserve is converted to a physical bill printed by the Treasury. And so in this case, the Treasury would mint a $1 trillion coin. Who knows what it was actually made out of, maybe gold, just for, to maximize whatever value you could pack into a $1 trillion coin. But then they would deposit that at the Federal Reserve, and then the Federal Reserve would credit it to the Treasury's general account. And then the federal government could circumvent the legislative need to increase the debt ceiling. What it only signals for everybody else who has any lick of common sense is that the charade is almost over. That when that we're getting to this point where the
it's desperation.
Yeah, it's very clear to a lot of people that the inmates are running the asylum right now, and the inmates are the congressmen and women who throw around words like trillions and $1 trillion deficits, and that it's going to be a $3.5 trillion bill, but that it's going to cost zero. That when they start getting to the point where they will say we will print a $1 trillion coin, and that there's a guy like Joe Weisenthal who's on Bloomberg that goes out and says that there's sound economic and legal theory behind it. Like these people to the actual adults are children. And it's becoming more and more evident. Will Cole, who's a colleague of mine at Unchained Capital, also lifelong friend of mine from here in Austin, he was interviewing his mother-in-law, Senator Lummis, at this Texas Bitcoin event 2 days ago, and he asked her about the $1 trillion coin, and she had a really funny response. It was, she's like, well, I would say that if you gave me $6 trillion coins and I gave you 6 egg rolls, that would sound like a fair deal.
I mean, it is a total breakdown in trust, and very concerning that you have these entities trying to circumnavigate elected officials through desperate means of minting a coin that's worth $1 trillion. I mean, it's a little unfathomable, to be quite honest with you, when just hearing it and it being so publicly talked about. And then, like you said, you have journalists that are covering it with this lens. Well, do we call Joe a journalist? I don't know at this point. I mean, he's covering it in a way that is suggesting that it's common sense, that it makes sense that this is what should happen. And it's like, what are you talking about? Like, this is crazy talk.
Yeah. And I think that the beautiful thing about it is that when the Fed affects quantitative easing, like most people, when they say that Bitcoin is complicated, they have no understanding of the US financial system, the plumbing of it, how it works. But that's also why they can get away with quantitative easing. They're like, it's complicated. Like the people design. that explain it, like, it's not really printing money. It's they're swapping one liability for another. And then you start using swapping liabilities for another, and you've lost somebody at the door. And that what ends up ultimately happening is in the last year and a half, they've printed 4.5 or 4.7 trillion. And, kind of effectively, they doubled the money supply. When people don't immediately see, 100% inflation the next day, they're like, well, they've printed money before and quote, nothing happened. It just happened slowly. And it ultimately will come to the logical endpoint. But when they get to the point of doing things so ridiculous as we're going to mint a coin that realistically it's not going to be made out of gold, it's probably going to be made out of nickel or copper that's, worth the equivalent of, 15 cents, and say that is worth $1 trillion, that the QE thing didn't make sense to people, but it was complicated. This just articulates in very simple terms.
Yeah.
Like something is incredibly wrong here at multiple different layers. Do they think that we're idiots? Eject. That becomes a thought process. It really distills it down for people.
I love this point, because let's say that they do keep raising the debt ceiling and they keep doing what they have been doing, which is QE. What they're effectively doing is minting the $1 trillion 15 cent coin. It's just in these different terms and much more confusing and much more difficult for the common person to grasp. But all they're doing is they're bidding interest rates, or they're bidding the price, pushing interest rates lower. And then I think the thing that so few talk about is the capitalization rate of the equity market, because interest rates keep getting compressed more and more down to zero, because there's a premium, a 2% premium above that risk-free rate that's being bid into the equity markets. And so the market cap of all that stock, anything that's equity-based, is going to the moon as they continue to do these QE policies down to 0%. And that's not talked about. It's not even discussed. And I can't even imagine how many trillions that adds up to just based off of the QE of the manipulation in the federal funds rate and in the bond market. But you have all that other spillover effects that go into the equity markets because of those risk-free rate premiums.
Yeah, I mean, that is a reality. The other framework that I think about it as, in the decade following the Great Financial Crisis, the Fed printed $3.6 trillion, or digitally created. However, again, people like Wiesenthal will be pedantic and say they digitally created $3.6 trillion. From 2007, beginning of 2008 over the next decade, I'm trying to get my frame of reference right, to 2017, 2018, the credit system grew from about 50 trillion to about 73 trillion. So for $3.6 trillion added to the system, it created, it basically got lent out more and more, and $23 trillion of credit was created. Well, that $23 trillion of credit that's created on top of $3.6 trillion in new base money that exists, that ultimately finds its way to financial assets. So for every dollar that essentially enters the system, it's those dollars that are entering the system which manipulate the cost of credit, both Fed funds as well as all other interest rates, all other dollar interest rates. The supply of dollars, what drives dollar interest rates is supply and demand for dollars.
Yeah.
How do you drive interest rates to zero? Flood the market with more dollars on the supply side. But then once those new dollars exist in terms of base money, more and more credits created on top of it, and those deposits find their way ultimately to financial assets. So it's like, not only does the actual, on a first order effect, does the leverage increase, but that the flow of funds, because it ultimately, if people are looking, whether it's a pension fund looking at kind of unfunded liabilities and needing to find return in different parts of the market, then it pushes them into the equity markets. But ultimately, there's a, those are more, I'd say third order effects. There's actually first order and second order effects directly tied to the base money, then tied to the new credit that is created as a function of that base money that spills into the equity markets as well. But everything will go down in Bitcoin terms, despite all of the money printing. But that's also because when the market is looking for real economic growth and activity, there's more and more dollars slushing around, kind of less productivity gains, more zombie companies. Everything from a valuation perspective at any historical valuation metric, whether it's PE, EBITDA, whatever it might be, or EV to EBITDA, however somebody looks at value, everything's ridiculous. And so as more and more dollars slush around, find their way to the equity market, because formerly credit investors are now equity investors, which creates, kind of malinvestment in itself. They're all looking around for water, like they've been starved in a desert for 40 years. And, slowly people find Bitcoin and they realize that the gig is soon up.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Long Angle is a private network dedicated to identifying and accessing the best private market investment opportunities. Long Angle is a vetted community of 3,000 very high net worth investors who manage more than $40 billion in assets. Members leverage their collective experience and scale to access and underwrite some of the world's best alternative investments. Diligence teams made up of members who have spent a career in each asset class underwrite every opportunity. Deals range from private equity, search funds, and private credit to secondaries, venture, and energy. Long Angle does not charge membership fees, but does require an interview and validation of investable assets. Long Angle is a community of investors, not a wealth manager. Members are treated as partners on every deal, with full transparency to diligence and underwriting. All members receive equal access to negotiated fee discounts. For more information and to apply for membership, visit longangle.com. That's longangle.com. Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
All right, so the ETF discussion seems to be getting hot and heavy these days. Many saying that they expect something to actually get cleared through the SEC here pretty shortly. From what I understand, it's going to be a cash-settled ETF-type vehicle, not a physically settled Bitcoin. What are your thoughts on the ETF in general, then maybe some of your thoughts on cash-settled versus physically settled ETFs?
Well, I think that the ETF, if I go back to 2017, when Gemini submitted for an ETF and they got rejected from the SEC, my reading of that response was, and that was asking for a physically settled ETF, that there were like nine or 10 reasons why they said they were rejecting it. And I read it though as, I was at Hayman at the time, so it might have been 2016 or it might have been early 2017. But I read it as, if you fix these 9 things, I'll come up with another 9 things. That it was basically a signal of, under no circumstance do we want a Bitcoin ETF. Now, that was at a time where I think Bitcoin had I don't like to think about it as marketing cap or of market cap, not marketing cap, but a purchasing power of probably 15 to 20 billion. Now it's in excess of a trillion. Now much larger institutions are, at least publicly, whether there were some then or not, that there are very large institutions that are involved in Bitcoin that have power and influence. And so I think that the same though is true now as it was then, that really the SEC has no interest in a physically settled Bitcoin ETF. I think realistically, they don't have an interest in any ETF, but that there are interests now involved that make that untenable, and that the best cop out is an ETF that is based on the CME futures, or whether it's a CME combination of CME backed, however they look at it. I guess that's really up to the issuer. Each one will present, kind of their plan. I ultimately think that it's a sideshow. Truthfully, I think that the only thing that is positive to come of it is that it will legitimize Bitcoin in the eyes of some, and it will make it more difficult for the federal government to reverse course and take really onerous actions against Bitcoin. They're going to, nothing good for Bitcoin is going to come out of DC. A lot of good is going to come out of the states, you know, on the state legislative side or governor side. But my point is that Washington DC and Bitcoin are not, you know, are not friendly. But I do think that even if a cash settled ETF were approved, that would, you know, in certain ways kind of create an opening that would make it more difficult for somebody to come out and say, we must ban Bitcoin, you know, whether it's Brad Sherman or some other clown that exists in Congress. And so I think that is a positive. Realistically, an ETF is, you know, a small step better than GBTC as a way to own Bitcoin. But practically speaking, it also has everything that is negative about GBTC involved. The more people that, you know, kind of think of Bitcoin as a financial asset rather than a monetary asset, like there's a reason why, you know, Pizza Hut and Starbucks and there's another large company. What's the one in El Salvador? But there's three large companies, Pizza Hut, Starbucks, and McDonald's are accepting Bitcoin for payment and they're not taking Facebook stock. That there's a fundamental difference between, or even a U.S. Treasury for that standpoint, there's a fundamental difference between a monetary asset and a financial asset. An ETF is effectively treating a monetary asset like Bitcoin as if it was a financial asset. And what have you done as a result if you buy it through an ETF? You've taken on unnecessary counterparty risk. And you've basically opted in to an inferior way to own Bitcoin when you could have owned it in a superior way. And so the example that I use is GBTC. Even though GBTC is a trust structure and not an ETF, the reality is that GBTC is custodied at Coinbase custody, based on my understanding. So if you decide to buy GBTC, you have Coinbase's counterparty risk, you have Grayscale's counterparty risk, you've got Grayscale's parent company, and then you've got whoever your broker is, that whose name it is held in. You likely have four layers of counterparty risk. And so if you could just go to Coinbase and own it at Coinbase and have one layer of counterparty risk rather than adding unnecessarily on three additional layers of counterparty risk. So an ETF might be better because you can, you know, they'll be structured to manage to NAV, but from a way to hold Bitcoin, you know, you can hold your own keys and eliminate counterparty risk. You can hold it with Coinbase, or you can do the Coinbase route and add on four layers of counterparty risk. Like, why would you ever do that? So I think that the only true benefit is, yes, more money will flow in, but that the true benefit is that it gives credibility. And that it really cuts out a leg. It's like when people were worried about China, oh, Bitcoin mining's, you know, concentrated in China. Well, now it's not. So you no longer have that complaint. As soon as a ETF is approved of any fashion in the United States, that then the argument that the US is going to be, and Bitcoin is going to become more ridiculous to parrot.
Do you think that it's going to have any type of price impacts because now more people have access? Despite all the arguments that you make, which are clearly, you know, all valid, do you think it's going
to? I think that realistically, I think that it would be more fooled by randomness than actually having an impact. That what's also happening at the same time is that what is happening beyond just an ETF is that Bitcoin, more plumbing is being built every day.
Yeah.
More, you know, kind of different institutions opening up rails, right? Like NYDIG working with Fiserv to turn on the ability to buy Bitcoin at your local regional bank so you don't have to go over to Coinbase. Basically lighting up that plumbing without you having to onboard with another financial institution. Like something like that to me would be more impactful than an ETF. But if I think about it in that context, it is more ways with more partner institutions are lighting up the little button that says buy Bitcoin. And that is happening as a function of knowledge distributing. More and more people are finding out about Bitcoin. Bitcoin, every time that somebody on the periphery believes that Bitcoin died, it didn't. And then it comes back into their conscious at or near an all-time high. And so, yes, you know, certain pools of capital will open up and they will, you know, buy an ETF when they wouldn't otherwise. But to me, that doesn't doesn't change the adoption curve. You know, that is not something that fundamentally shifts it. And it would be one small thing that would happen alongside of other even larger macro shifts, but it would be a single thing where people would be like, oh, the price went up because of an ETF. And like, no, the price went up because more billionaires and 100 millionaires and millionaires and, you know, every worker in the country figured out that the Federal Reserve is printing trillions of dollars and that this thing, Bitcoin, isn't just magical internet money, that there's real innovation in digital scarcity and that it's the foundation of a future monetary system. Maybe I need that. And so I think that the ETF will be a good headline, but it would be more of a fooled by randomness.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I definitely agree with you in the short term here. If it does roll out and we see that and if the price would go up, I don't think that it would necessarily be because the ETF was approved. Where I could see it having an impact is further out in the timeline when, let's say, the price just really starts to rip. Let's say the price blows through 100,000 and it gets to 110 or 120,000 in short order. And you have people who don't have a Coinbase account, don't have a Kraken account or whatever exchange you're talking about, but they do have their TD Ameritrade or whatever they use. And they just now type in a ticker and they smash buy for that ticker that they all have access to in retirement accounts or whatever. And I think that could have an impact just because you have access to so many more people and the frictional hurdle of them having to open an account at an exchange has been removed. I think that could have an impact.
Look, I mean, I think that if I was thinking about it from a fundamentals perspective, it's like, does it change the fundamentals? No, obviously not.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't the reason to own Bitcoin has not changed because an ETF exists.
Yeah.
Is it a better product than GBTC? Yes, absolutely. You know, kind of ETF far superior to GBTC's product. It creates competition in the market. It will actually be managed by people that know how to manage an ETF. So the product itself will be better. So there will be some marginal demand for that, because what you just described, most people can go do with GBTC. That's what's happened, right? Like a bunch of RIAs have plowed their clients into truthfully a bad product because it's the only thing available. So those people that want to buy it via that mechanism, practically speaking, have something. That is like, as flawed as it is that if they want dollar exposure to Bitcoin rather than Bitcoin itself, there is something in the market. And that what we also see is that, you know, the way I describe it is that price is an output. It's an output, and that monetary properties are the input. And that when, you know, the scenario that you describe, when Bitcoin gets back through its all-time high and is screaming and double and people are FOMOing and buying it because they have no idea what's going on, it's because there was actually a fundamental signal that was sent that more and more people stared at the equation of Bitcoin, the Fed, the ECB, the BOJ, the insanity that's going around, saying, no, actually, Bitcoin makes sense to me. I'll adopt that because more and more people are going to adopt it because it actually has sound, incredible monetary properties. And so I always like to come back to a fundamental in something like this, because the only reason that Bitcoin will be higher than its prior all-time high as denominated in dollars or euros or any other cross of currency is because somebody evaluated the fundamentals and accumulated when everybody else was panic selling. And that is why Bitcoin doesn't die. And so when that happens, though, like, that's when Coinbase goes down, because literally their user base 10x's. When people are motivated to do something, they will go through the pain and do it. And what exists today is that it's not just Coinbase, but there's River, there's Swan, Unchained, you know, more and more places popping up to buy Bitcoin, that it's all of the different possible network connections where people can make it easier and easier that causes that. So it's like people actually go through a lot of pain if they're particularly motivated. I do agree that on the margin, there will be some universe of people that now, if, you know, iShares has a Bitcoin ETF, they'll buy that when they wouldn't otherwise buy GBTC. But I do challenge that, you know, kind of more so it will be driven by, you know, somebody might not have gone and opened up a Coinbase, you know, when the price of Bitcoin was going from 60,000 to 30,000 and they were about to, you know, dance on its grave before it rose like a phoenix from the ashes, as it always does. But that then when Bitcoin's 120K, that got the same person that was like, nah, I'm not buying it, it's dying, that they'll be motivated to open up a Coinbase account and not tell their friends and buy some. So
Michael Berry just blocked you, Parker.
Yeah, he might, or Mike Green, I don't know.
Hey, do you think that the typical person has the capacity to self-custody Bitcoin? When you just think about your common person that knows nothing about any of this, do you think that they have the capacity to take ownership of this, or do they need to outsource something like that?
I think that the normal person, yes, will self-custody. I think that it is actually easier to do than securing funds on Coinbase. And that is for technical reasons, that it's actually, there's two things that happen with self-custody, and we're talking about people's life savings, right? In many cases, again, a lot of people, Michael Saylor has a quote that is, you know, if you actually understand Bitcoin, there's no way that you only own 1% of it. And that's true, that if you actually understand what Bitcoin is and why it exists and how fundamental it will be to our entire economic system being viable or you know, and then flourishing into the future, that Bitcoin will be the solution to that. You don't just have 1% of your wealth, because you have 99% of exposure. That's what you figure out along that path. And that if you have an amount of money that represents your life savings, or a large share of it, because when you do truly, like when Bitcoin clicks for you at a fundamental level, like, you're going to have more than 50% of your assets in Bitcoin. That this isn't like, you know, RIA portfolio theory. We're like, we should have 1% of this and 2% of that. It's like, no, this is the best form of money that's ever existed. It's not too volatile. It's going to be adopted by 7 billion people. And I'm going to own a lot of that. That if you're in that world and you have them, whether it's, you know, 50% of your portfolio or something that you just can't afford to lose. We saw a week or two ago about how 6,000 Coinbase accounts that had 2FA set up were hacked and drained. Imagine that was your life savings. Like, would you ever put yourself in a scenario where even if it happens to 0.5% of people or 0.1% of people, that is too high of a probability to put yourself into a ruin event type scenario. Now, in that case, because there was some error on Coinbase's side, that Coinbase made those folks whole. But before Coinbase, there have been any number of scenarios. There was the Canadian exchange, there was the South African exchange, there was Mt. Gox before it. That there is a reality that people believe that holding Bitcoin, the keys to your Bitcoin, is daunting because there's permanence to private keys. But once you actually hold private keys, you and generally people that are used to storing things that are valuable understand that things don't get up and walk away. There's high degree of redundancy, such that if you lose a key or even lose a key and a backup or multiple parts of your security setup, that there are ways, and that's what we focus on at Unchained Capital, helping people self-custody in ways that are highly fault tolerant and eliminate single points of failure, so you can make numbers of mistakes and still have your Bitcoin. That the difference between self-custody and cold storage and working with an exchange or a third-party custodian is that when you work with a third-party custodian, you 100% in all scenarios have a single point of failure. that you have a single point of failure because first and foremost, it's permissioned. And you know, if you see what's happening in Lebanon, people can't get their money out of the banks because it's an abject disaster. Bitcoin, you can hold on a permissionless basis, and that gives you and grants you an incredible amount of power. But more from a technical perspective, why I say that self-custody is actually easy and why more and more people do it, if it represents a material amount of their wealth, from a technical perspective, it is much more difficult to secure a password and to avoid the consequences of living in a permissionless or in a permission system where someone could just say, no, I'm not going to give you access to your money, that being your single point of failure, than it is in a world where you actually sever. Bitcoin is a digital bearer asset. And when you have your own keys and you have cold storage, you actually sever the internet connection. That it is, you massively reduce your attack surface when the way for somebody to get a hold of your Bitcoin is no longer accessing your account on a remote basis at an exchange like Coinbase, like hackers did to 6,000 people. But when your keys live in a combination of safes and safe deposit boxes geographically distributed when you need more than one key to move any Bitcoin. And so the analogy that I use to simplify it for people is that, you know, when think about or envision how many times you access your money in the dollar world. Maybe you affect 5 or 6 transactions in a day, maybe fewer. But you're accessing your funds about 0.1% of the time, or maybe less, 0.01%. But there's an internet connection around the clock that is there to access your funds. You're actually spending, at least in this day, your Bitcoin less frequently. So you're generally just checking on it to check balances and that it's there. But think about in the Bitcoin world, when you have a Coinbase account, like you only ever move Bitcoin maybe once a week, maybe once a month. Realistically, it's probably fewer than that, once every 3 months, once every 6 months. But when you're sleeping 24 hours a day, you're connected to the only way that you have to access your Bitcoin. In that world, you have massively increased your surface area. And so what we do, and that's why the longer that somebody holds Bitcoin, the more likely they are to self-custody, because they understand that dynamic. It is actually harder to secure a password to an account that your only way to access is remote. It's actually easier to take a physical key and put it in a physical location and physically is secure. That somebody, and this is also not to say that everyone has to have guns, but when somebody can hack you remotely versus have to come into your house or also get to a safe deposit box, but they're less likely to do that because they're going to have a higher probability of having physical harm. So as we kind of develop solutions, which we are today, we onboard a lot of people who are first-time Bitcoin buyers directly to holding their own keys. Because we use multisig, because it's collaborative custody, because we're there as a partner, I think that will be the standard. That in 4 years, when people own Bitcoin, the idea of going to Coinbase will sound foreign. That it will be flipped. Because the solutions will get better, but that the market will also have more and more education about trial and error. And the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that it eliminates moral hazard. It pushes ultimate accountability to the user. That if 6,000 Coinbase users get hacked, as bad as I feel about that, again, in that case, they got that make it whole. But usually when Coinbase accounts get hacked and money gets drained, they don't. That doesn't impact me. I've got my Bitcoin. There's no socialized losses. There's no counterparty risk. And for people that actually understand Bitcoin, understand that it is a finitely scarce resource. And there is a reality that markets do have no memory. But for listeners of your podcast that remember 2008 and 2009, counterparty risk is a thing. And that when you find out that it's a thing, it's probably too late. And so those that are smart and that actually understand Bitcoin and understand its value will start to realize that the power that you gain from having permissionless access to your money and by eliminating counterparty risk and eliminating single points of failure, that is the smartest and best way, and it's actually achievable. There just is a knowledge gap that needs to be bridged, and There's more and more companies that are helping to do that. Ours at Unchained Capital being one of them, but there's other good companies out there too.
Talk to us about your ideas on tax planning, because a lot of people that listen to the show have a decent net worth. They might have substantial gains on their hands. How do you think about tax planning under those, for those people with that situation, and particularly for anybody holding Bitcoin?
So first I will say that I'm not a tax attorney. This is not a tax advice, but that it is definitely true that as more people accumulate a non-immaterial amount of money, and as Bitcoin exists into the future, that that people start to think about passing on wealth to their family, but that also thinking about, you know, kind of the technical aspects of inheritance planning. So, you know, I think there's a technical aspect of actually physically how does this get passed down, and then there's the tax side of, there's nothing new about it in the sense of everyone always wants to maximize the amount that they can allocate how they choose, whether it's to family or whether it's to charities rather than the federal government. You know, and I think it's important that people kind of understand that frame of mind. I think that one of the things that we're doing at Unchained is we recently brought on Jeff Andrew, who is our head of retirement and inheritance. That the first thing that Jeff is working on is an IRA product where people can hold their own keys. With that, we've actually started the pilot. There will be a broader launch in the coming weeks. But that he's also focused on the question of inheritance, and that kind of there's the aspect of holding Bitcoin in such a way with a plan, so that it doesn't get caught up in a court process, and whether it's held in trust. A lot of people are evaluating whether to hold it in trust, where they can avoid painful probate processes. But that also, in order for people to actually have credible plans that they're confident in, not just for estate planning purposes, but for tax planning purposes, that more of the people that actually have the knowledge and expertise to plan need to get involved. What we've seen is that more attorneys are getting focused in this area, and that there will be more and more services coming out from Unchained and others. I don't have, kind of particular strategies that I would say, other than, when I talk to my parents or talk to older folks, they generally think about retirement or kind of tax planning. Ultimately, before you get to that point, you need to understand kind of the fundamentals of Bitcoin, which I think, is still a 99% problem, and that you're going to need Bitcoin to buy groceries in the future. I think at some point in the future, and this isn't necessarily specific to your question, but it is pertinent to the tax question. I think at some point the federal government will change the tax treatment of Bitcoin to whether they make it legal tender to treat it as currency. And through that, they will likely accelerate capital gains because they're going to need the federal government to be capitalized with a form of money that actually functions. And so I think that the most important kind of order of effects is understanding Bitcoin, why you should own it, understanding then how to secure it so that in the future you have access to it, and then figuring out how to minimize your taxes. But I also operate with the reality that a whole lot of things are going to change because of Bitcoin. And I focus a lot more time and energy on the first two and never selling my Bitcoin so I don't incur taxes.
Last question I got for you is on the Bitcoin lending side. I think I had this conversation with you privately where we were talking about the various risks that many of these lending platforms have inherently because of their institutional books versus their retail books. Talk to us a little bit about your ideas or your opinions on the lending space as it exists today. And then how do you see this evolving into the future so that it becomes a little bit more secure and not as risky as maybe it is right now?
Yeah, I think that, and I can't remember when we came on, but I believe it was either 6 months ago or like 18 months ago.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
It's probably about six months ago. Yeah.
Okay. I knew that it was like April, May timeframe, but
yeah,
you know, the last year and a half feels like an eternity. So, so we have a pilot that we've contemplated and worked on with an exchange that would essentially hold Bitcoin in collaborative custody while Bitcoin is on loan. I had an exchange and effectively able to trade. And the idea behind it is that kind of how certain goods or stocks trade on an exchange can be and oftentimes is and should be different than how those assets are custodied. An example being that in the, kind of today in the Bitcoin exchange world, all Bitcoin is generally held on exchange rather than in third-party custodians. That is very different than the worlds of stocks and bonds. New York Stock Exchange does not custody any stocks, but it trades a lot of stock. And that the stock is oftentimes actually custody at the DTC. And so this idea that, if all Bitcoin lending that happens today, like no one's lending Bitcoin to go build a building. So that's an important thing because there's a reality in the dollar-based world that everyone kind of was trained to earn interest. It's like, oh, if you're not making your money work or earn interest, you're doing something wrong. And they don't think about the risk that they're actually taking when they do that. So yield doesn't like, and this is going to sound crazy, but it might not sound crazy to a few people who doesn't do it because it might actually describe them. There's some people that just think that interest magically shows up. that you put your money in and they pay you some money out and how that happens, they don't know, but it just does. And I say that kind of jokingly, but it's also true that people think that when they put money in a company that pays them Bitcoin yield, that like money is that, like I've talked to people where they think that when they deposit Bitcoin to BlockFi, that the money is just, the Bitcoin is just sitting in BlockFi and they're earning interest. But what really happens, because it's not specific to BlockFi, it's the only way that any Bitcoin lending works is you deposit your Bitcoin in, they take your Bitcoin and move it out, or if it's at the same custodian, it's at a different account, transfers out of the account of the person that you gave it to, and it's not there and it's at risk. And so that's the first thing, that you're taking something that is a finitely scarce asset, that in my view represents the greatest asymmetry that's ever existed in the entire world. And you fundamentally change the nature of what it is you own. You had that, and now you have counterparty risk of multiple institutions, essentially. And that if you're lending into a black box and you can't evaluate the nature of those counterparties, and you're trusting institutions that are ultimately very young, and you're doing that in a world where what they're lending is a finitely scarce asset in which there are no bailouts, like you're making a decision with an amount of information that you need more of. And so what we were contemplating is an arrangement where you have a known counterparty, you have a known way of how that Bitcoin is actually custody, and that no single party would be in control. And that there'd be an idea that if all Bitcoin that is lent, kind of getting back to the point where I started, was that the only way that they're able to pay yields in Bitcoin is that the returns are generated via sub-trading activity. You're lending Bitcoin oftentimes for someone shorting Bitcoin, and they're trying to make income based on volatility. And they're not necessarily just directionally short Bitcoin, they can be arbing Bitcoin spreads, long on Kraken, short on Coinbase, long the futures, short the spot. It's not just people. There are some crazy people out there that are just directionally short Bitcoin. Those people are going to need some serious help at some point in the future. But there's a reality that all income that is derived and paid on yield products in Bitcoin lending is the counterparties are trading firms. That gives me a lot of pause and should give a lot of people a lot of pause. But that if you are going to structure a product, if you recognize that all Bitcoin yields are derived from firms that are pursuing some sort of trading activity, that ultimately that Bitcoin winds up on exchange or some venue where it's trading. So our idea was to go to the exchange, enter into a collaborative custody arrangement where you could certify how the Bitcoin is held, that the exchange isn't singularly in control, and that you could actually lend in a capital efficient way on a secured basis, rather than today what happens is that all lending is to trading firms and on the institutional side, generally on an unsecured basis, not say 100%, but given the nature of the problem that it solves, which is one of capital efficiency, it's why many firms borrow Bitcoin. They have to have dollars in Bitcoin posted all over the place to pursue ARB strategies, that it's generally on an unsecured basis. I don't think that Bitcoin should ever be lent on an unsecured basis. It is too precious of an asset and counterparty risk is too real to do that. What ultimately happened with our product was when that we'll likely have it out in the future, but when the spread of the GBTC trade went from a premium to a discount, which it fundamentally should trade at a discount, a fairly steep discount, given the nature of the product, that the demand for Bitcoin borrows collapsed. And that caused the market interest rates to collapse. And so ultimately there were firms that had promised certain level of yields, and they were essentially going to anybody that was remaining in the market to borrow Bitcoin and driving interest rates down. And it got to the point where we were like, okay, well, you know, this market structure doesn't make sense. There's no kind of rational defense to lend Bitcoin at these nominal rates. And so we just kind of deferred it. But I do think that still is the vision. We will have that out at some point in the future, but the market structure just needs to come in a bit and rationalize.
Parker, I could talk to you all night. Thoroughly enjoyed this. Every time we get a chance to talk, I just love talking. You're so smart. I wasn't going to ask another question, but I had this one written down and it relates to what I'm saying right now. So Sammy asked, I'd love to know how he learned to think the way he does. Your ability to reduce to first principles is unmatched and very unique. Give us a tip. What can people do to be better at dissecting critical thinking and getting down to first principles?
I think you just have to, you have to start at being really dense. I've never consciously thought about that.
Well, do you read a lot? Do you read a lot?
It's a hard question to answer. I think that it's that there's a lot of noise, and I'm actually fairly risk averse. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as an example, when I was getting into Bitcoin, Bitcoin made no sense. And then as I, you know, had the benefit of being able to meet Saifedean Ammous before he wrote the Bitcoin Standard, there were a number of people that I met that helped me understand things I didn't know before. And so it was that it was like Bitcoin clicked for me. Like it started to make sense. But I had a bunch of ideas jumbled up in my brain where it was like, you know, kind of like a lightning strike where like, oh, okay, that makes sense now. But now I have to actually get back to that same point with reason and logic to reaffirm that it's actually a defensible position. And so I try to think, and that's a lot of what I've done with my writing. And then that writing, once I was able to distill it down, kind of like I carried that forward, or at least that thought process down, which was I kind of recognized something about Bitcoin, but it was before I could describe it. And in order but then in the process of actually distilling my thoughts, it was going down in a very logical, rational way to say, okay, that idea that just kind of triggered in your mind of like Bitcoin makes sense, that it's going to be money and the whole world's going to adopt it. Like, you know, break that down into like the 100 different parts to how your mind just put that all together in one flash. And I think about it as also trying to get down to the things that you're most certain about. And so with Bitcoin, it started with, as an example, I know independent of Bitcoin, why the federal government is going to print trillions of dollars. I have a fundamental understanding of the construction of the U.S. financial system. And I think I have an understanding of it, not maybe, you know, kind of technically how they actually click buttons and print $3 trillion. But I think I understand the cause and effect better than the people at the Fed do. And so, but I also know that that system will not last. And so like I use that as an example that like, that was my anchor as I was looking at Bitcoin. It was like, that is certain in my mind. The timing is uncertain, like when it happens, how it happens, but that it happens is true. Okay, if that is true, then there has to be a solution. What is the solution? Is Bitcoin viable as a solution? You know, and as we go further out in time, more things are uncertain, but the things that you know will be certain at some point in the future guide all other thinking, in my view. So it's just kind of trying to get down to always, and it doesn't just apply to Bitcoin, it applies to other things, things that I kind of, way I would think about investments when I was at Hayman Capital, but that kind of going to the least common denominator, the assumption that you know to be true, and then the thing that all other assumptions build off of, as a general way of thinking. So to being put on the spot like that, I don't know if that adequately thought about it, but it probably ties back to just being risk averse and also kind of generally a logical or rational mind to be like, okay, am I crazy with this Bitcoin thing? And the only way to prove that I'm not crazy is to get to that same kind of flash of an idea where like probably 100 different ideas come together all at once in an actual reasoned way. And so with my writing, I really tried to just say, okay, I had to struggle through all of these things myself. Let me unpackage the ideas that are in my head and the things that I struggle with, because many other people would struggle with them as well. And actually through the process of writing, you might find that, you know, that is the way to always bring things back to first principles. Because oftentimes I would write something and I'd say, well, no, that's not a logical connection. Like there's some other, there is a logical connection. That thing I just wrote on paper is not it. Like, let's try it again. And it's just iterative.
That's so true. Especially if you're going to publish it in a public kind of way. I know when I'm writing something, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to get hammered if I would publish this or put this out into the public. And okay, let me ask myself why 5 times on this particular point and see if it really kind of holds up as I kind of drill down on it. It's a great point about writing. I like that. If people want to learn more about you, Parker, where can they find you? I know you're active on Twitter. Anything else that you want to highlight? Just let it rip.
Yeah. Find me on Twitter, Parker A. Lewis. Read my writing. I've got a series on Bitcoin called Gradually Then Suddenly. It's on our website. I'm head of business development at Unchained Capital, based here in Austin, Texas. So you can find us on unchained.com. And then all of my articles are on the blog. I write the Gradually Then Suddenly series, and then also we'll write a number of other things about our company, about financial markets. So on our website, unchained.com, you can find it on the blog, and then also on Twitter, Parker A. Lewis.
And if people don't know, Michael Saylor has quoted saying that some of Parker's writing, the stuff that he was referring to earlier, was some of the things that convinced him to become a Bitcoiner. So kudos to Parker and his contributions to the space. Love having you on. You're just a total wealth of knowledge, and thanks for making time.
Preston, always enjoy it. Appreciate you having me on.
Hey, so thanks for everybody listening into the show. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe to the show on whatever podcast app you're using. We really appreciate that. And if you have time, leave us a review. So thanks for joining us this week, and we'll catch you next Wednesday.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.